Well, hello there. Harry Brown here, and this is Sunday afternoon, so this must be the Money Show, brought to you every Sunday for an hour to talk about the economy, your money, finances, economics, whatever has anything to do with money. And you can ask a question if you like, or make a comment, or dun me for a bill, anything you want. Call 1-800-259-9231. That's 1-800-259-9231. Or, if you're shy, just send me an email. The address is question@harrybrown.org. Last week we opened a study of economics to understand what economics can do and what it can't do with regard to handling your investments, what an understanding of economics can and cannot do. And if you found that interesting, we will continue on that study this week and perhaps even going into next week. But first, I received an email just before the show started, which posed a very important question, which I think should be answered. It came from Rob in Canada. And he said, after I've read articles and books of investment advisors, they always seem to have an alternative reason. The author or advisor pushes his newsletter, gold coins, insurance plan, mutual fund, whatever. Immediately, it makes the advice less believable. Now you, Harry Brown, have an interest in a mutual fund company. One of your sources of revenue is public speaking on investments. So how should I believe you that you're not, that your investment strategy is not something that you have developed in order to sound unique and to attract buyers of your books and services? Very good question, Rob. In other words, why should you believe me? The fact of the matter is you shouldn't. You should believe yourself. All I can do is to offer suggestions and ideas that you may not have heard elsewhere. But it is you that must decide whether the ideas or the suggestions make sense, not whether I'm a good or bad person, not whether I have selfish reasons. None of those things are important. What is important is that you examine the ideas, and you have to make the decision yourself. Why do you have to make the decision? Because you are the one that will face the consequences. If you do something that I suggest and it doesn't work out for you, I won't be there to share your losses. You will have to handle those losses completely by yourself. And if you do very, very well with your investments, I won't be there to share in the profits either, although we ought to work out some kind of an arrangement. The fact of the matter is that anything you buy, any product, a computer, a car, a banana at the grocery store, all of these things are provided to you by people who have selfish reasons for providing them, and that is they want something for themselves, which is your money. And that's no different from my being associated with various companies. Actually, I'm quite independent. I am a consultant to the Permanent Portfolio Family of Funds, which is one of the sponsors of this show, and which in part makes it possible for you to hear this show. And by the way, the Permanent Portfolio Family of Funds can provide information for you if you call 1-800-531-5142. It's 1-800-531-5142. Yes, I do speak on investments from time to time, presenting my investment strategy. And yes, I have written books on the subject. Fail-Safe Investing is available to download to your computer from libertyfree.com, libertyfree.com. Gee, I appreciate your asking this question, Rob, because it gives me a chance to summarize all the things I have a self-interest in. But it still comes back to the fact that what I do is present ideas. Now, why am I presenting this particular strategy? Because 25 years ago, I realized that nobody can predict the future, and I had to come up with something, not just for the people who buy my products, but I had to come up with something for myself. I had made a great deal of money in the 1970s, investing in gold, silver, and Swiss francs, but also in advising people to do so. A lot of people paid me a lot of money for my advice. But that run was over, and I realized that it was a once-in-a-lifetime situation, and I had to come up with a way of handling my own investments, the money I had made into the 1980s, the 1990s, and beyond. And that is what led me to the permanent portfolio strategy. And, of course, I then passed that strategy on to people who read my newsletter and in the subsequent books that I wrote and in the speeches that I gave at investment conferences. And now that I have a radio show, I am certainly pushing that strategy because 25 years of employing the strategy has convinced me that this is the one thing, the only thing that I know of that people should do with the money that they cannot afford to lose. With the money that's precious to them, they must have it in a diversified and balanced portfolio that will protect them whatever comes, because they cannot predict whatever is coming. And all those people out there who claim to have wonderful track records of predicting all kinds of monumental events in the past are either padding their results, or they are failing to recognize that they were lucky, or they are forgetting to mention to you the predictions that they made, which may have had as much force in their newsletters or books as the predictions that came true, but which did not come true. And so that is why I push this strategy. My interest these days is much more in politics than it is in investments, and I give far more speeches on politics than I do on investments, and I do far, 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 far more writing on politics. But the strategy that I propose for your investments is timeless. It does not require me spending a great deal of time looking at charts and graphs and examining what people are saying on the website. The only purpose in doing so would be to analyze those ideas on this show. So, there you have it, Rob. The reason you should listen to me is because I am a source of suggestions and ideas. And it is the same reason that you should listen to anyone else who appears to have something that you haven't thought about before and that you feel you need to think about. So, I hope that has answered the question. Rob also asked, gold seems to have a 20-year cycle, and the new cycle is underway, and who knows whether it has already reached a high. If so, why should I invest in gold? My life may not last much longer than 20 to 25 years. One would think that with stocks having an upsurge, that gold prices would go down. Why is that not so? Well, it's not so, first of all, because there's no such thing as a 20-year cycle in gold or in anything else. Cycles do not occur in human action because individuals change, and as a result of those changes, any time period that passed between events before is of no value in looking at the future. We'll explore that just a little bit more, because there really is no such thing as cycles or waves in human action, and therefore they are useless for handling your investments. This is Harry Brown, and this is The Money Show, and we will be back right after this break. This is Harry Brown. You've worked too hard for your savings to risk them on somebody's grand plan to double them. Wouldn't you rather have a safe, secure portfolio, one that grows steadily each year without the wide swings in the investment markets? For 25 years, I've shown people how to have such a portfolio, one that made money the past few years rather than losing heavily. Now you can get that same help from my book, Fail Safe Investing. You can have that secure, bulletproof portfolio. You can download Failsafe Investing at LibertyFree.com for only $9.75. Then read it on your computer screen or print it out and read it in your easy chair. The book can give you the security you crave without becoming a speculator or a market whiz. Go to libertyfree.com to read a sample chapter and then start protecting your savings. Failsafe investing can be yours tonight at libertyfree.com. Well, welcome back. This is Harry Brown, and this is The Money Show. And I'm so glad you're with me this afternoon. Before we went to the break, and before we go to the phones, I was talking about the cycles that Rob asked about. He said there was a 20-year cycle in gold. Human beings do not operate in cycles because human beings learn from their activities and change their activities as a result. Now, the changes they make might be right or wrong in terms of actually helping them fulfill their desires, but the fact is that they do continually change their activities as a result of their previous activities, of what they learn from it, of what they have gained from it in resources and so on. And you can see this in gold, for instance. There is no 20-year cycle. Gold for approximately 40 years was stuck at $35 an ounce. That was actually about 38 years. And then it went up for about 10 years, and then for the last 25 years, it has been relatively dormant. And the recent rise in gold is nothing like the bull market that took place in the 1970s. But investment advisors frequently want to believe in cycles as a way of predicting the future and a way of getting customers to look at their charts and say, look here, I have discovered this cycle, whether it is in wheat or in the consumer price index or whatever it is. And the cycles are imposed upon those graphs even though they really don't exist. And there's another point we should notice about cycles and waves and all these things. In the physical sciences, a scientist would never claim that there is a cycle in something unless it happened thousands of times and could be repeated by another scientist setting up a similar experiment and seeing that A leads to B, and it does so hundreds and then thousands of times over, and then the scientist is in a position where he can confidently say, yes, there is a cycle, that whenever A happens, B follows, or that A comes around every so many time periods, whatever it may be, a matter of seconds, a matter of years, whatever it is, that A continually repeats itself. But in the human sciences, in the science of human action, and specifically in investments, an investment advisor will say, hey, look, there's a 12-year cycle in something, wheat or corn or something else, and what he has seen is that there are three periods of roughly 12 years where wheat or whatever has hit a new high or a new low. And so the investment advisor confidently says, look, you can see that it comes every 12 years, and now it has been 11 years since the last low. We're getting to the point where we're at a low, so you should be starting to accumulate this in particular investment, whatever it is. Well, three cycles does not make any kind of a theory. In the physical sciences, to say that would be immediately to make yourself the laughing stock. But that's what's done in the investment world. People are always looking for a shortcut, for a way that they can get a glimpse of the future, for a way that they can let the mechanics of graphs and charts dictate to them at any given time what they should be in. And I'm sorry, but these things just simply do not work. Anything might work in the short term, and anything might not work in the short term. But when it works in the short term, it is no guarantee that it will work in the long term. Because if you take all the possibilities, then certainly at some given time, something is going to repeat itself three times over. But that doesn't mean there's any natural law governing it. All right, Let me get off the soapbox and let's go to the phones. And our first call today is from Steve in New York. Hello there, Steve.
Hello, Henry.
What's up?
Well, you're talking about something that just hit me pretty hard in the head here last week, financial security.
Mm-hmm.
Victimized by identity theft. Some of that computer leakage that they've been talking about on the news must have come my way. Tried to use a charge card to pay for some gas, and it was declined. And when I called up my charge card company, some mystery person pretended they were me, had all my security information, and moved my account to Bronx in Brooklyn and tried to buy some computer equipment on me.
Oh, that's really terrible. How much did you lose, roughly?
Well, the automatic fraud detection software figured out that I didn't move to New York and then buy $3,000 worth of computer equipment in 20 minutes, so they shut the accounts down, and it looks like they didn't get anything.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's good for the credit card companies, and that's good for me, but the real problem was is how easy it was for somebody to hack in or get this information they're talking about on the media and pretend to have my identity and change one of my accounts.
Well, you know, this brings up a very important point, and that is that when problems like this develop in the free market, it is always to somebody's advantage, to somebody's benefit, to somebody's profit, to develop a way of countering it. And that's why we see credit card companies guaranteeing you against identity theft now in order to get your business, because somebody has provided them with a system whereby they can catch most of it before they lay out the money, and they can, and because they can catch most of it, they then can insure what they don't catch, because the insurance company looks at it and says, all right, you're only going to have a small number of claims. We'll be willing to insure those that you can't catch so long as you keep the claims below a certain volume. And
well, that works for the business because they can work on the margins of money. But in my case, it happened to me 100%.
Right, but you didn't lose anything because the
credit... No, I don't know. I don't know yet. I'm waiting to see how many more accounts these people that have pretended to be me can manage to get into.
Right.
Because this information isn't very secure, apparently.
Well, one thing that you can do on your own, and I will try to dig up the website and give you put a link on my website, and that is that if you get a credit report, and sometimes they're provided free by a credit company that turns you down for a credit card, they say, we will give you a free credit report if you want it to explain why we turned you down. And in other cases, you can just simply buy it for some, you know, ridiculously low figure, like $25 to $50 a year. And what happens is they send you a report every week by email telling you that no one has tried to access your credit. No one has asked whether your credit is good or bad or anything else, meaning, let me back up, no one has accessed your credit report. And that means that no one has tried to acquire something using your credit as the guide for it. And
well, I'm not sure that's how they got this information.
Well, it is one way that you can be apprised when this is happening and take steps to respond to it.
Yeah.
If you have something further to say, Steve, hang on. We are going to a break now. This is Harry Brown, and I'm so glad you're with us. We have a half hour to go, so don't go away. This is Harry Brown. My book, Fail-Safe Investing, will tell you what you need to know to create your own bulletproof investment portfolio, one that will protect you whatever the future brings, prosperity, inflation, recession, even depression, and it will protect you without your having to predict the future or tinker with the portfolio. Best news of all, at libertyfree.com, you can download the book for only $9.75. That's right, just $9.75. You can read the book on your computer screen or print it out and read it in your easy chair. If you're tired of losing money on your investments, tired of the pressure of looking for the best investments, Here's the way to have your own bulletproof portfolio, no matter how big or small your savings. To get a free sample chapter from Failsafe Investing, just go to libertyfree.com right now. That's libertyfree.com. Well, welcome back. This is Harry Brown, and this is The Money Show, brought to you in part by the Permanent Portfolio family of funds. And you can get information on the funds by going to permanentportfoliofund.com. And we were talking with Steve about cycles, and I guess I made my point, whether or not anyone wants to accept it, that you should not pay any attention to cycles and waves in investment markets or in economic indicators, because they simply do not have any validity in human action. Now, we were talking last week about economics and the use that economics can put can be put to in investments and in just studying the economy and so forth. And I defined economics as the study of the use of limited human resources in order to satisfy as many as possible of unlimited human desires. In other words, we all have unlimited desires. Satisfy one desire and it creates another desire because of the new status that you have. And there are so many desires and so little resources with which to satisfy them that we have to choose among those desires. We have to prioritize and make sure that we satisfy the most urgent of those desires rather than wasting our limited resources on desires that are way down the list. And one of the unfortunate things about government management of the economy and interference in the economy is that it takes some of these resources and applies them to something that politicians think is important, either because they really believe that we should have hydrogen-powered cars or a dam in Tennessee or whatever it is, or because the people who support them want those things, and so they do that in order to get votes. But whatever the reason, what they are doing is taking some of your resources and applying it to desires that you may not even have, or if you do have, are way down on the list of desires that you have. If you'd kept that money, you most likely would have applied it to desires that are at the top of your priorities. But instead, the money is really wasted on something that is not nearly as important to you. But this is what economics is, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about the world, the nation, a company, or your own personal life. What you are doing always is trying to decide how to use the very limited, scarce resources that are available, and in applying them to try to satisfy the most urgent desires. Now, one problem with this is that you cannot use the science of economics to predict the future or to try to determine even what's happening in the present sometimes the way you could in the physical sciences. And I explained last week that the physical sciences deal with things that are predictable and that always act in the same way, whereas the sciences of human action, whether you're talking about economics, psychology, sociology, or whatever, are dealing with human beings who do not remain the same. Now, one of the problems that this creates then is that history gives us no clues to human behavior. I shouldn't say that. I should say that history does give us clues to human behavior. I misspoke there. But you can't use history to prove any kind of economic theory or any kind of cause and effect relationship. Because no matter what one group of people did at one time, another group with different values may have may behave differently in a situation that seems to be similar to the one before. Even if the same people are involved, the circumstances are going to have changed in some way. And even if the people and the circumstances somehow were both the same, something that rarely happens, the reactions will be different because the people know how matters turned out the first time, and they will take that into consideration in deciding how to act the second time. History does have one purpose in economics, and that is that history can refute an economic principle. In other words, you can use history to prove that something does not always happen. Someone states an economic theory saying that A always leads to B, and if you go through history and you find an example where A didn't lead to B, then of course you can say that history has refuted it, because the person has tried in presenting the economic theory to make it seem as that this is an absolute, that A will always lead to B. And to sum that up, we can just say that chemicals and metals, they don't think, they don't make choices, they don't learn from experience, and that's why things that happen in chemistry and physics and so forth are so predictable. But human beings do think and learn both well and badly, and that means that we can never be sure what human beings will do tomorrow. There's a common cliche that I've heard over and over and over and over again in the years I've been involved with investments. And the cliche is, human nature never changes. But even if that's true, two aspects of human nature are, number one, that desires are continually changing. So the employment of human nature changes because it's directed first here and then it's directed there and so forth. And secondly, the ability to learn new ways to achieve whatever is desired again means that human nature will not be employed in the same way. Now, for a practical example, we can look and see that this bull market rose three times over the starting point of the market. But that doesn't mean the next bull market will go up three times over. This bull market started 8 years after the last bull market ended. But that doesn't mean there'll be an eight-year interval in the next one. None of these things are going to repeat themselves. Now, another thing we should recognize is that because human theories can't be tested and refined by the methods used in the physical sciences, the principles of economics have to be developed through what is called deductive reasoning. An economist attempts to apply to each question what he believes about the way human beings act. Now, the basic principle of economics is each individual will do what he believes will best satisfy the desires that compete for his resources, whatever those desires may be. Now, there's no way to prove this basic principle. We arrive at it through deductive reasoning by our observations of the way human beings act in general. Now, this principle doesn't tell us what will happen at any specific time in the future, but it does tell us a great deal about human beings, and it does help to lay the foundation for many economic theories. We'll cover this a little bit more when we return, but don't go away. This is Harry Brown, the phone number 1-800-259-9231. We'll be right back. Well, we're back. This is Harry Brown, and I've been talking about the application of economics to investments, and economics, of course, applies to a great deal of great many parts of our lives, even those that don't involve money, because we're still talking about the use of your resources, which includes not just your money, but your time, your energy, everything else. Everything you have is limited. There's only so much of it, and so that's why we make choices. And as I said, the basic premise of economic theory is simply each individual will do what he believes will best satisfy the desires that compete for his resources, whatever those desires may be. And you can simplify that just by saying everyone will act in his own self-interest, whatever that self-interest may be. For one person, it may be making as much money as possible. For another person, it may be feeding the poor. For another person, it may be bringing world peace to the world. For another, it may be listening to music or developing new ideas for business simply for the creative satisfaction of it. Whatever the self-interest may be, it is what drives the individual. And this helps to unify all of human action. It helps to make it easy for us to understand other people. It helps to understand what other people are doing and why they are doing it and how we must approach them if we want something from them, meaning we have to appeal to their self-interest, whatever that interest may be. It also tells us then that if we're trying to get an agreement from somebody, we need to first understand what his self-interest is so that we can show him how what we want will help him satisfy that self-interest. Now, some people, of course, plan 20 years ahead, while others think only of immediate gratification. So even though each person's goals, priorities, talents, nature, and emotions are uniquely his own, this principle, this simple universal principle, is the premise upon which we build an understanding of human behavior. Every individual uses his resources in the best way that he can imagine. Whenever he buys, sells, or trades something, he does so to improve his situation. Now, he may not sub-vocalize all of this that I'm talking about every time he makes a decision, but he doesn't have to because he simply acts in his own self-interest. Now, from this premise, an economist works outward, trying to deduce further economic principles. And because only individual human beings act, the economist starts out to develop a principle by pondering how one individual in isolation tries to satisfy his desires, and then moves from there to how individuals interact with each other and influence one another, and then come to questions of how an entire national economy works. So the economist arrives at conclusions such as the principles of supply and demand, how the money supply affects inflation, how changes in corn prices affect the prices of hogs or the supply of hogs, and what consequences ensue when government prevents individuals from engaging in various kinds of transactions. But even the best economist isn't so wise or so ingenious that he can be sure that each step forward in his theory is completely consistent with the nature of human action. He can't be sure that the economic truth that he thinks he's discovered won't later be proven false by some events that occur sometime in the future. So we begin with the limitation that we can never be sure how economic theories that we use are perfect and are eternal. Henry Hazlitt, in his wonderful book, Economics in One Lesson, which I strongly recommend for anyone who wants to better understand economics and how it affects national economic policy and so forth, in his book, Henry Hazlitt said the art of economics consists of looking at the future consequences as well as the present consequences, and at looking how various acts affect people that we can't see as well as the people that we can see. Now, this is a restatement of Bastiat's famous dictum about things that are seen and things that are not seen, that we shouldn't just look at what's in front of us when deciding how well an economic act has satisfied the basic human desires of the people in the economy or whatever. But Hazlitt's key word was art. Applying economics is an art. a talent, something that is inborn, rather than a skill that one acquires just by a lot of reading. And some people are very good at that art, and those people are probably better speculators than people who don't have that talent. And you cannot replicate that talent by that person with the talent reading a book and you, pardon me, writing a book and you reading that book that he's written, because he can't transfer his talent to you through words. We may want to act on this person's advice more often when speculating, but we can't simply make ourselves into that person by reading his book any more than when we could become opera singers by reading a book by Luciano Pavarotti. We'll be right back. This is Harry Brown. This is Harry Brown. Have you lost money in stocks over the past few years? From 2000 through 2002, the stock market lost a third of its value. But during those 3 years, a bulletproof portfolio gained 9%. And over the past 34 years, such a portfolio gained an average of over 9% per year throughout periods of prosperity, inflation, and recession, with no wide swings in value. My book, Failsafe Investing, shows how you can have that kind of portfolio for yourself. And now you can download the book for only $9.75. You don't have to rely on alleged market wizards or stay up late worrying about your savings. Failsafe Investing will show you how to have the security that you crave. Go to libertyfree.com to see a sample chapter of Failsafe Investing, and then start protecting the savings you've worked so hard to acquire. That's libertyfree.com. Well, with that happy music, we can look forward to a good week this coming week, and I hope you do have a good week. I looked up those quotations that I gave you just a moment ago. What Frederick Bastiat said 150 years ago is, there is only one difference between a bad economist and a good one. The bad economist confines himself to the visible effect. The good economist takes into account both the effect that can be seen and those effects that must be foreseen. And then Henry Hazlitt restated it back in the 1940s when he said, the art of economics consists in looking not merely at the immediate, but at the longer effects of any act or policy. It consists in tracing the consequences of that policy not merely for one group, but for all groups. And of course, that's what politicians don't do. They just spend the money without looking at the long-term consequences, not just the debt they're piling up, but how spending that money may create bad consequences for the economy in the future. And they look not at all groups who are affected and having to pay for this policy, but just at the group that's going to benefit from it. And so they wind up spending money on things that are way down on the list of national priorities. And then they say, oh, but we need the money for the ones that are up, further up, and so they spend even more money then and pile up these huge debts that we are supposed to make good at some time in the future. There's a great deal that is exciting about economics, and part of it is because there is no final proof of any economic theory, and that creates a certain sense of excitement and adventure, and it also leads to a lot of mistaken ideas that are peddled around. But we're going to pursue this study of economics further in the broadcast, and I think you may find it very, very interesting, especially in the application of economic theory to various things that happen in our lives, especially pertaining to our money. So we will continue this, but we will also, of course, take questions and get into other subjects in each broadcast. The broadcast will not be limited to just economic theory and the application of it. But we still come back to the fact that we live in an uncertain world, And the first step in dealing with your investments is to recognize uncertainty and resolve to deal with it and not expect to overcome it. We are not going to overcome the fact that we live in an uncertain world. We are not going to find a key to foreseeing the future so that we change uncertainty into certainty. It simply is not going to happen. But we can deal with uncertainty in our investments just as we deal with it in every other aspect of our lives. You don't know for sure that you're going to be able to stay married forever to the same person. You don't know whether you're going to be able to work out at that new job you have, but you deal with this uncertainty, and you can deal with your investments in the same way. And we, of course, will continue to talk about that in future shows. So I do hope you will come back. This is Harry Brown. Thank you so much for listening today.
Come back. Come back, sweet papa.